Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to everyone in an effort to help them awaken to universal truth. If you want to learn about spirituality, the occult, and all things related to metaphysics, you are in the right place. Everyone, welcome to Intuitive Awakening. My name is Dina. Thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode. I hope everybody has had a great start to their new year. This week, I am covering The Mastery of Destiny by James Allen. James Allen, if you aren't familiar with any of his books, he was a British philosophical writer, and he was known for several inspirational books and poetry, and he was a pioneer of the self-help movement. Now, I chose this book, and you know, if the title already sounds enticing, it's even better because it's shorter. The book is quite small. I think it's about 70 pages long, so it's kind of a quick read, but it's packed full of very useful information. Now, I chose this book because I know that we are at the start of the new year. And many of you, like myself, you have a laundry list of goals this year or dreams that you're really trying to realize. And I think this book is helpful to understand the necessary steps to take to manifest. So in this book, James Allen, he shares some practical methods to understand how to quote unquote master our destiny. And I do want to say, you know, at the outset, practical methods. The information in this book is not new for us. For some, it's probably going to be a little quote unquote outdated because we have, I would like to say at the start of The Secret, we've gained a lot of this information. However, I think it, you know, warrants another look given that sometimes, in my personal opinion, when people are trying to manifest, they forget the fundamentals to manifesting. So I think this will be very helpful in that aspect. So let's get started. At the beginning of the book, James Allen likes to talk about what destiny really is. Now, for most of us, destiny, you know, sometimes it's referred to as fate, a predetermined course of events. It can also be conceived of as a predetermined future. However, James Allen, he kind of diverges from this viewpoint. He says that destiny in itself is a matter of a multitude of choices made over a period of time, specifically a collective of choices consisting of thoughts, deeds, and words made every day. In return, it becomes the habitual patterns that we take on, which eventually becomes our reality. So thus, unlike our future outcomes being predetermined for us by something outside of ourselves, he says that we are the determiners actively every day by our thoughts, words, deeds, and choices. And for Allen's time, you know, this was really a radical viewpoint. We now accept it as fact due to our understanding of the law of cause and effect. But again, I would say for his time, it was definitely very different given the fact that many people, and I think still many people today, think that there are, and this is a long conversation that I should not actually be trying to detour into. Let me just bring it back to the topic. I just think that some people, yes, believe that events are predetermined and that we don't have a lot of control, but really James Allen is saying, no, we actually do have quite a bit of control here. Okay. So speaking of the law of cause and effect, this is the first thing that Allen jumps into at the beginning of his book. And he reminds us about the power of this law and how it impacts our ability to quote unquote master our destiny. Every effect has a cause, and the cause is our choices and words, our thoughts and our deeds. And we create the cause. But he says the hand of the universe decides its effects, Sound familiar? So, per James Allen, man finds himself involved in the train of causation. His life is made up of causes and effects. It is both a sowing and a reaping. Each act of his cause, which must be balanced by its effects. So we choose the causes. This is our free will. However, we cannot choose, alter, or avert the effect, which that's what he calls fate. Thus, free will stands for the power to initiate causes, and destiny is involved in its effects. It is therefore true that man is predestined to certain ends, but he himself has issued the mandate. Again, since the introduction of books like The Secret into the modern world, this information sounds redundant. Other people who have heard of The Secret, and I know The Secret is not the only book, but we're all familiar with it, so I'm using that as a standard example here. Many people who have heard of the law of cause and effect, they usually come back with this one question, because if they question whether or not the law is true, they'll essentially ask you this one thing so that they can get your answer and maybe trip you up, right? They might ask you, well, if this law of cause and effect is true and that we are the creators of reality, then why do bad things happen to good people? That's always the question, right? Why do bad things happen to good people if we have experiences in life that we surely never thought of, that we surely never tried to create? But if the universe is created by this law of cause and effect, then how can these two things go together? This is something that James Allen actually does not even try to avoid discussing in this book. He tackles it straight on. So I'm going to read to you, if you have the book, it's on, I believe, if you have the same book, it's on the page 13. So he says, "And now let us consider how the law operates in particular instances in the outworking of destiny through deeds and character. First, we will look at this present life, for the present is the synthesis of the entire past, the net result of all that a man has ever thought and done is contained within him. It is noticeable that sometimes the good man fails and the unscrupulous man prospers, a fact which seems to pull at all moral maxims as to the good results of righteousness out of account. And because of this, many people deny the operation of any just law in human life, and even declare that it is chiefly the unjust that prosper." Does that sound familiar? Do we all not have that common thought? Do we all not see what's happening in life? That, yeah, it does seem to look like on the outside right now, there's a lot of corruption. It seems like the quote-unquote bad guys are the ones that are winning, right? Those are the ones that are prospering. But he says, nevertheless, the moral law exists and is not altered or subverted by what he calls shallow conclusions. It should be remembered that man is a changing, evolving being. The good man was not always good. The bad man was not always bad. Even in this life, there was a time, in a large number of instances, when the man who is now just was unjust, when he who was now kind was cruel, when he who was now pure was impure. Adversely, there was a time in this life, in a number of instances, when he who was now unjust was just, when he who was now cruel was kind, when he who was now impure was pure. Thus, the good man who is overtaken with calamity today is reaping the result of his former evil sowing. Later, he will reap the happy result of his present good sowing, while the bad man is now reaping the result of his former good sowing. Later, he will reap the result of his present sowing of bad. But when just causes are not apparent in this life, Then they were set, then they were set going in former lives. And indeed, the entire evolution of any being through innumerable births and deaths and ever-enlarging destinies may be regarded as one long extended, one indestructible, ever-growing, ever-changing, and ascending life. In this book, James Allen, he wants us to realize that it is our character that is destiny itself. And I want to repeat that. It's our character that is destiny itself. Our character is the sum of all of our thoughts and deeds. And he says that man is the maker of his own character because he has the sole control over his thoughts and deeds. And in turn, he is the sole controller of what he attracts, which means that he is the maker of his reality. And we are what we think about all day long. Thus, we really do, you know, we are the maker of ourselves. An individual's destiny is just a reflection of that individual, who this person became in his or her thoughts, feelings, words, and deeds. So if the reflection is unsatisfactory, then you have to change the person, or the person needs to change, not the mirror. All the mirror is doing is showing you yourself. In order for the image to change, the individual has to change first. And only when this happens will reality reflect a different image. The laws of the universe are consistent and they're concise. So no one can force your free will. It's ours. So if we decide to think, be, and live in a negative way, then we have to deal with the consequences of those decisions with full responsibility without creating really any excuses for our shortcomings. Okay, so in order for us to manifest our destiny, James Allen says that first and foremost, we have to go about cultivating what he calls self-control. You must control yourself so that you can control your destiny. A person that's not, I would say, rattled or affected by outside circumstances, and that stays poised and within themselves in every and any circumstance, is somebody who really exercises self-control. A person who loses themselves in emotions is not a person of great power, but, as he calls it, a weak individual who bends to the moment, right? So again, they don't have self-control. A man cannot acquire self-control and become possessed of the wisdom and peace-giving knowledge which that self-control confers, but by many years of patient labor, a labor which is all the more arduous because it is silent and unappreciated by others. Therefore, you know, for our purposes, self-control is unfortunately something that we have to exercise time and time again, and it requires a lot of patience with ourselves. Now, to gain self-control, he says specifically, we need to become just like a scientist. And he gives a lot of examples of this, right? We have to become like a scientist in our own psyche, really, by reviewing ourselves like a scientist would look at a cell under a microscope, which he tells this very specifically in the book, how really self-analysis is super important for us to gain self-control. So he says that a scientist, number one, does an observation of nature to gain a reference point. The scientist is going to look at how nature acts, how it responds, and what the creative force is behind it. Number two, then they would experiment by gaining theories from nature and testing it out in a controlled environment. Or sometimes they, you know, test it out on themselves. Number three, they will use their findings and classify them by true, not true, or not sure to help define laws by which something becomes true in every experiment. Four, they will create deduction, finding substantial truths that are hidden from the naked eye, which leads to five, knowledge of the facts so profoundly that he or she can relay it to others to advance their own lives. The attainment of scientific knowledge is not really the end. We do not attain knowledge for ourselves alone, nor do we keep it locked away. The end of such knowledge, or acquiring such knowledge, is use or service, the increase of the comfort and happiness of the world. Therefore, when a man has become, quote unquote, a scientist, he gives the world the benefit of his knowledge and unselfishly bestows upon mankind the results of all his labors. Thus, beyond knowledge, there is a further step which includes six, use. That is the right and unselfish use of the knowledge acquired. So in order to gain self-control, you have to become like the scientist, right? But you have to become a scientist of yourself. And you have to discover how you think and how what you do relates to the laws of nature that you were born into. How do we do this? Well, he says, number one, we do this through introspection. So we have to search our mind and we have to review our what he calls base impulses or our motivating forces or our unreflective urges, our desires to act. And then we have to get to the root of them. You need to ask yourself why you think a certain way or why you act a certain way. We have to get to the root of that first. So introspection is super important. The second thing that we have to do is self-analysis. We have to observe the results of our thinking and our actions and then classify them. He says classify them according to good or bad impulses, but I know we don't like the words good or bad. Therefore, I would say, you know, if they're harmonious or not, or if they're in alignment or not. The next thing is adjustments. Based on introspection and the self-analysis, you can then make some needed adjustments. This is something that James Allen calls weeding, sifting, and cleansing. He says, as a farmer weeds, cleans, and prepares the ground for his crops, so the student removes the weeds of evil from their mind, cleanses, and purifies it to prepare it to sow the seeds of righteous actions, which will produce the harvest of a well-ordered life. So during this stage, it's important to make a complete attempt to switch from, you know, switch to a positive mindset and positive actions that would really benefit you. And then you have to actively choose, I would say, a positive outlook, positive words, positive thoughts. The next stage is righteousness. It's at this stage that you're no longer really supposed to be a slave to your impulses and circumstances. You're being asked to realize the law of cause and effect and only think, speak, and act in a way that is just and fair and positive and helpful regardless of the circumstances. And then the last part of the last stage is what he calls pure knowledge. And I'm going to read what he says because I think it's super helpful. So by thinking right and acting right, he proves, or you prove by experience, the existence of the divine law on which the mind is framed, and which is the guiding and unifying principle in all human affairs and events, whether individual or national. Thus, by perfecting himself in self-control, he acquires divine knowledge. He reaches the point where it may be said of him, as of the natural scientist, that he knows. He has mastered the science of self-control and has brought knowledge out of ignorance, order out of confusion. He has acquired that knowledge of self, which includes knowledge of all men, that knowledge of one's own life, which embraces knowledge of all lives. As for all minds are the same in essence, differing only in degree, are framed upon by the same law, and the same thoughts and acts by whatsoever individual they are wrought will always produce the same results. But this divine and peace-bestowing knowledge, as in the case of the natural scientist, is not gained for one's self alone. For if this were so, the aim of evolution would be frustrated, and it is not in the nature of things to fall short of ripening and accomplishment. And indeed, he who thought to gain this knowledge solely for his own happiness would most surely fail. So beyond the fifth step of this pure knowledge, there is still a further one which he calls wisdom, which is the right application of the knowledge acquired, the pouring out upon the world, unselfishly and without stint, the results of one's labor, thus accelerating progress and uplifting humanity. It may be said of men who have not gone back into their own nature to control and purify it, that they cannot clearly distinguish between good and evil, right and wrong. They reach after those things which they think will give them pleasure, and try to avoid those things which they believe will cause them pain. The source of their actions is self, and they only discover right painfully and in a fragmentary way, by periodically passing through severe sufferings and lashings of conscience. But he who practices self-control, passing through the five processes, which are five stages in growth, gains that knowledge which enables him to act from the moral law which sustains the universe. He knows good and evil, right and wrong, and thus, knowing them, lives in accordance with good and right. He no longer needs to consider what is pleasant or what is unpleasant, but does what is right. His nature is in harmony with his conscience. Okay. So, the other thing he says, in addition to gaining self-control, a person has to keep their minds free of distractions from the outside world. And I think we all know, again, this is super difficult given the modern age that we live in. How do we keep ourselves away from all of the modern lovely distractions that we enjoy? Well, we do this by cultivating willpower to master our destiny. So he does have a section on willpower. And willpower is really defined as the ability to delay gratification, resisting short-term temptations in order to meet long-term goals. It's also defined as the capacity to override an unwanted thought, feeling, or impulse. So according to the author, without the strength of your mind, or even without the strength of your will, nothing worthy of accomplishment can be done. You can't have both a weak and strong will and get something accomplished. So in order to cultivate willpower, there are seven things that you have to do that he says. So the first thing that you have to do, and this sounds so easy, but again, we need to ask ourselves, have we actively even tried? The first thing that we have to do is break off bad habits. And this is not an easy task, and he says that it will require a lot of effort on your part, but you have to identify what these bad habits are to overcome them, right? And he says that you're not really going to increase in willpower if you can't even do the first step, this first step. What weakens your willpower? What distractions? Some people will clean, as I've noticed, will find any excuse to clean anything. Some people have to shop. Some people have to organize. Some people have to watch TV. Some people have to read Facebook, Instagram, Twitter all day. And there's always an excuse, right? There's some sort of bad habit that's weakening your will. So first you have to break off those bad habits, identify them, and find a way to overcome them. The second thing that you have to do to cultivate a very strong willpower is to form good habits. And he says specifically the increased strength of will, which is gained by success in overcoming bad habits, enables one to initiate good habits. For while the conquering of a bad habit requires merely strength of purpose, the forming of a new one necessitates the intelligent direction of purpose. To do this, a man must be mentally active and energetic, and must be a constant watch upon himself. As a man succeeds in perfecting himself in the second rule, which is forming good habits, it will not be very difficult for him to observe the third one. And this third one he calls giving scrupulous attention to the duty of the present moment, which means being very, very attentive and in the present moment, paying attention to what it is that you're doing and being thorough. Thoroughness is a step in the development of the will, which cannot be passed over. He says that, you know, sloppy work is an indication of weakness. Perfection should be aimed at, even in the smallest task, by not dividing the mind, but giving the whole attention to each separate task as it presents itself. Singleness of purpose and intense concentration of mind are gradually gained, two mental powers which give weight and worth of character and bring repose and joy to their possessor. So, in addition to breaking off bad habits, forming good habits, and giving attention to the present moment, we are also asked to do the task at hand immediately. In other words, avoid procrastination. So the fourth rule, which is what he calls it, is really, yes, being in the present moment and doing what needs to be done immediately. He says specifically, idleness and a strong will cannot go together, and procrastination is a total barrier to the acquisition of purposeful action. Nothing should be put off until another time, not even for a few minutes. That which ought to be done now should be done now. This seems like it's a little thing, but it's actually very important because it leads to strength, success, and peace. So additionally, he does state that it's important that you live your life according to certain rules. And he doesn't tell you what rules to live by. But he does say that if there are certain principles, a certain philosophy that you adhere to, then you must live it thoroughly. I think that in our community, and I am also guilty of this at times, you know, you read a lot of theories, a lot of different, tax belief systems, but it's difficult to apply them, right? It's hard to find the practical application to daily life. But what he is saying is find that application to daily life and live by that. Don't just live it in your mind. Live it through your action as well, and live accordingly and be consistent. Because if you are consistent in this, it helps to increase your willpower. Okay, the next rule, he says, is control the tongue. He says the sixth rule, that of controlling the tongue, must be practiced until one has perfect command of his speech, so that he utters nothing in peevishness, anger, irritability, or with evil intent. The man of strong will does not allow his tongue to run thoughtlessly and without check. So be mindful of what you're saying, always. All of these six rules, if they're faithfully practiced, they will lead up to the seventh, which is the most important of them all, which he calls controlling the mind. Self-control is the most essential thing in life, yet it's the least understood. But he who patiently practices the rules that he just laid down, bringing them into requisition in all your ways and undertakings, will learn, by experience and effort, how to control and train your mind, and to earn thereby what he calls the supreme crown, which is the crown of a perfectly poised will. So in addition to willpower and self-control, and being mindful, of course, of the law of cause and effect, he has a section on mind building. In order to master our destiny, we must give great attention to our minds, of course, right? James Allen, he does speak of a process that he calls mind building. And he says that every man is a mind builder, whether they recognize it or not. And he has a really great metaphor here that I'm going to read to you because I think it's super helpful. You'll understand it better. But in addition, I think there is a point of reference here that you'll find quite familiar. He says every man is a mind builder, whether he recognizes it or not. Every man must perforce think, and every thought is another brick laid down in the edifice of mind. Such bricklaying is done loosely and carelessly by a vast number of people, the result being unstable and tottering characters that are ready to go down under the first little gust of trouble or temptation. Some also put into the buildings of their minds large numbers of impure thoughts, These are so many rotten bricks that crumble away as fast as they are put in, leaving always an unfinished and unsightly building, and one which can afford no comfort and no shelter for its possessor. Debilitating thoughts about one's health, thoughts concerning what he says, unlawful pleasures, weakening thoughts of failure, and sickly thoughts of self-pity and self-praise are useless bricks with which no substantial mind temple can be raised. Pure thoughts, wisely chosen and well placed, are so many durable bricks which will never crumble away, and from which a finished and beautiful building, and one which affords comfort and shelter for its possessor, can be rapidly erected. Bracing thoughts of strength, of confidence, of duty, inspiring thoughts of a large, free, unfettered, and unselfish life are useful bricks with which a substantial mind temple can be raised. And the building of such a temple necessitates that old and useless habits of thought be broken down and destroyed. So this is kind of reminiscent to me of like building your house on, you know, rocks or sand, right? If you build it on sand, then everything can be withered away, right? There isn't a stable foundation. So to me, being very mindful of the words that you're choosing, of the bricks that you're laying, right? In what he calls the mind temple, is super important, because again, everything stems from thought. This is something that I repeat all the time. But you have to, because we're always in the process of building our minds, and we have to be conscious of what we're saying, conscious of what we're thinking, knowing that we actually do have cosmic power within us, and it comes from our minds, because that's all we are, our minds, and the thought, you know, in the mind of God, really. And we create through the mind. Therefore, we have to be very cognizant of that. And this is something that he stresses in his book. Now, while he doesn't speak about affirmations in his book, I actually think it's important to mention here, in reference to the process of mind building. Affirmations are, they're really simple, they're short, and they're powerful expressions. So when you say, think, even hear them, they become thoughts that create reality. Research shows that there are between 45,000 and 51,000 different thoughts that cross our minds in one day. That's 150 to 300 thoughts per minute. And unfortunately for most people, 80% of these thoughts are negative. This is something I talk about a lot again. Because unfortunately, this is our society, right? A lot of us, when we were raised as children, we're raised to see the worst case scenario. We're raised to always think in the negative, as opposed to thinking, you know, in the positive way. Affirmations, they're sentences aim to affect the conscious and the subconscious mind, so that in turn they affect our behavior. They affect our thinking patterns, our habits, and environment. The words composing the affirmation automatically and involuntarily bring up related mental images into the mind, which inspire, energize, and they motivate. The affirmations and the resultant mental images, they get engraved on the subconscious mind, which in turn changes the behavior, habits, actions, and reactions according to the repeated words. So if you use affirmations, it's great because they motivate. They keep your mind focused on a goal. They influence the subconscious mind and they activate their powers. They change the way that you think and behave. And this can bring you into contact with new people who can help you with your goals. That's why it's so important. Once you shift your mindset, you shift your vibration. Thus, the universe has no choice but to bring like with like. Think about that. Once you quote-unquote up-level your mindset, you will be brought into contact with other people whose mindset is also up-leveled. That's wonderful. That's like a gift from the universe, because then that person, those people, can help you go about the process of achieving your goals. And of course, positive statements, they make you feel positive, right? They're energetic. active, and they put you in a better position to really transform your inner world and thus transform your external world. Now, with affirmations, consistency is key. You have to repeat them day in and day out. So you have to have a real structure, like a daily routine. It just can't be a one-off because you'll forget. Don't quote me on this, but I believe it takes 90 days to create a new habit, or it's 120 days now. I remember years ago when it was only 30 days. Now it's like 4 months for you to create a habit, or 3 months. But you have to create a routine here, a structure. Meaning that you need to have like a planner, you need to record it in your phone, and then have a timer and say them at least twice a day. If you are somebody who is extremely negative, I would say start with like 4 or 5 times a day. So start in the morning as soon as you can, so that you can have a positive day. Start thinking about your goals, your ambitions, of course, in the morning, and use some positive words about yourself. Say them. Again, I think, you know, the more negative thinker you are, you may want to say them again at lunch, and then a couple hours after lunch, and then, of course, before you go to bed. Because what we're trying to do here is impress thoughts into your subconscious mind and then solidify them day after day after day until they become normalized, right? So how long do you need to say them? Maybe a few minutes each time. Some people will you say them for 5-minute sessions. Some people will do 10 minutes. It's really kind of up to you. But I do think that a brief discussion here on affirmations was warranted because we need a way to retrain our minds, right? To have a little bit more willpower. So something suggestive words, I think is super helpful for us to break off bad habits and form new ones. Okay. In addition to self-control and cultivating willpower, James Allen says that now we have to cultivate concentration. So he notes that cultivating concentration is necessary for really succeeding at any task. Now, while this may seem like common sense, it's hard to do, especially today, again, given the number of distractions we have at our disposal. When we sit down to accomplish anything, most of us find that we are checking our phone every 5 to 10 minutes on Twitter, Facebook, or even Instagram. But these are distractions and they require the discipline of the will and discipline of the mind. So according to James Allen, the great enemy of concentration, therefore of all skill and all power, is a wavering, wandering, undisciplined mind. A scattered and undisciplined army would be useless, he says. To make it effective in action and swift in victory, it must be solidly concentrated and masterfully directed. Scattered and diffused thoughts are weak and worthless. Thoughts marshaled, commanded, and directed upon a given point are invincible. Confusion, doubt, and difficulty give way before their masterly approach. So again, focusing, concentrating on the task at hand, and finding a way to minimize the distractions or eliminate them altogether. Again, it's become second nature to reach for the distraction, whatever it is. And you have to ask yourself why you would rather invest in the distraction than invest in your goals. This is a big question, and I have my thoughts about it here, but I don't know that I will go into a diatribe about it. But most of us, unfortunately, we kind of do it. We spend quite a bit of time finding excuses as opposed to, you know, completing the task at hand. Okay, you guys. James Allen also talks about, of course, the practice of meditation. And I'm looking at my notes here just to make sure that I have everything. There was a lot of stuff in this book, and I just wanted to make sure I covered everything for you guys and did James Allen some justice. So he does talk about, of course, meditation. There's a lot of really useful information in here. And this book was actually written back in, let me double check. I swear it said 1909. Yes, the first publication was in 1909. So this information, again, has been available for so long. But somehow it's like it kind of, I feel like the self-help movement dissolved and then reemerged again in the 2000s, excuse me, early 2000s. I'm getting my timing wrong. But let's talk about meditation as he talks about it, because meditation is crucial for our mastery of destiny. He says concentration is necessary to worldly success, but meditation is necessary to spiritual success. Worldly skill and knowledge are acquired by concentration. Spiritual skill and knowledge are acquired by meditation. By concentration, a man can scale the highest heights of genius, but he cannot scale the heavenly heights of truth. To accomplish this, he must meditate. So I'm going to read to you what he says about meditation because I think it's super helpful. Okay. Meditation is therefore spiritual concentration, the bringing of the mind to a focus in its search for the divine knowledge, the divine life, the intense dwelling in thought on truth. Thus, a man aspires to know and realize, above all things else, the truth. He then gives attention to conduct, to life, to self-purification. Giving attention to these things, he passes into serious contemplation of the facts, problems, and mysteries of life. Thus, contemplating, he comes to love truth so fully and intensely as to become wholly absorbed in it. The mind is drawn away from its wanderings and a multitude of desires, and solving one by one the problems of life, realizes that profound union with truth, which is the state of abstraction, and thus absorbed in truth, there is that balance and poise of character, that divine action and repose, which is the abiding calm and peace of an emancipated and enlightened mind. He says meditation is more difficult to practice than concentration because it involves a much more severe self-discipline than that which obtains in concentration. A man can practice concentration without purifying his heart and life, whereas the process of purification is inseparable from meditation. The object of meditation is divine enlightenment, the attainment of truth, and is therefore interwoven with practical purity and righteousness. In meditation, therefore, the entire life of a man is involved, and as he advances in its practice, he becomes more and more fitted to perform the duties of life in the circumstances in which he may be placed, for he becomes stronger, holier, calmer, and wiser. Think about that. As he advances in its practice, he becomes more and more fitted to perform the duties of life in the circumstances in which he may be placed. He will become stronger, holier, calmer, and wiser, which will help us master what it is that we're trying to do here. The principle of meditation is twofold. Namely, number one, purification of the heart by repetitive thought on pure things. Number two, attainment of divine knowledge by embodying such purity in practical life. Man is a thought being, and his life and character are determined by the thoughts in which he habitually dwells. It's really important here to say again, even though he doesn't mention in here about positive word choice, about affirmations again, because he does say that we must dwell, we must focus on pure things, repetitive thought on what is pure, on what is truthful. And that is what meditation does for us. It brings us clarity of mind. It helps us to purify the heart so that we have better understanding. And when we have understanding, we can achieve better. We know better, thus we do better. He additionally says that the majority of men live in a series of conflicting desires, passions, emotions, and speculations, and there are restlessness, uncertainty, and sorrow. But when a man begins to train his mind in meditation, he gradually gains control over this inward conflict by bringing his thoughts to a focus upon a central principle. In this way, the old habits of impure and erroneous thought and action are broken up, and the new habits of pure and enlightened thought and action are formed. The man becomes more and more reconciled to truth, and there is increasing harmony and insight, a growing perfection and peace. Thus, you have more, again, of an enlightened mind, more of an understanding. There's a lot in this section on meditation here. I'm not going to go into all of this, but I just wanted to tell you briefly that he does tell you the indications of meditation. He tells you, you know, the best time, places, and conditions in which meditation is possible, the times, places, and conditions in which it is difficult. So I think it is worth a look as well. But there are other things in here that I didn't have the opportunity to discuss, but I think I overall covered almost everything. But if you can, exercise self-control, have a strong will to do what it is that you want to do, to achieve your goal, to create something and stick to your vision. And if you retrain your mind and shift your thinking from negative to positive, from thoughts that are not harmonious to those that are, and if you spend some time in the morning, afternoon, or evening, or all of it together, and work on retraining your mind and open it to be in connection with Source, then you will have more mastery over what it is that, over your thoughts, really. Over your thoughts, thus your actions, your deeds, etc. To mold your character. Because again, he said character is your destiny. At the start of this conversation, we spoke about the immutable laws of cause and effect. Every effect has a cause, and the causes are choices, words, thoughts, and deeds. Again, remember that we are the cause. Every day we make a choice to follow through with our plan, our goals, and visions for ourselves. Without self-control, willpower, concentration, thoroughness, mind building, and meditation, it will be challenging to master your destiny or even follow through on your goals and fulfill your purpose, right? I've met many people in my life who I call the kings and queens of excuses. And sometimes there are some legitimate excuses. I hear all the time, I'll do this when, ... I don't have time, ... And these are usually telltale signs of a lack of true motivation or drive, or there can be some underlying fear there, fear of failure more likely. But none of this negates the simple fact that you are the captain of your ship and you set its course and the direction that you choose to go in. The biggest takeaway from this book is that I think, this is what I really gained from this book, is that you are what you think all day long. Because again, your character is your destiny, and your character is a summation of your thoughts, actions, deeds, right? So you are what you think all day long. So consequently, you are the artificer of your own future. As you change your thought life or your pattern, you change your destiny. In addition to this, I did want to say, because I do understand that accomplishing really big goals or seemingly big goals can be really challenging for people, especially if you are a negative thinker or prone to negative thoughts, or if you have a huge underlying fear because what it is you're trying to create just seems super insurmountable, and you need support. I always tell people, you know, you need to find what I personally call an accountability buddy. This means you need to find somebody who is also trying to manifest their goals, and then the two of you, and I think it should just really be two, it can be three, but the two of you can have weekly or bi-weekly check-ins so that you both can see that you're following through on your incremental steps that you need to take to realize your goal. And then have this accountability buddy for the entire year until your goals are manifested. It's also really important that you write down your goals. People who write them down are more likely to actually fulfill the goal as opposed to those who do not. You guys, I hope that this discussion today on the mastery of destiny has been helpful for you. Again, it's by James Allen, and I'll put the links so that you can find the book online. Everybody, have a great day, and thank you for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.